Hey, welcome to the Upland Nation podcast. Scott Linden here. Glad you could join me. Great show in store for you. You tell me that one of your highest priorities is shooting better. Well, I can't think of a better guy to do it than Don Curry. Don is a bird hunter, but he's also the chief instructor of the National Sporting Clays Association. The guy knows how to put lead in the right places in the air, and he will have advice for us on the hunting aspects of how to do that. We'll also debrief on a couple trips, well, that I helped send him on, and looking forward to hearing all about that. But that's not all, of course. Looking at next season, well, I guess it's this season now, I'll be sharing some of the lessons I learned from the road for your rig and your dog, make life easier for both of you. And that'll be in our road trip section. And then finally, you're going to share some of your most important shotgun care advice, probably apropos of Don's appearance on the Upland Nation podcast, made possible by Sage and Breaker, Pointer Shotguns, Mid-Valley Clays, Trulock Choke Tubes, MidwayUSA.com, Purina Pro Plan Sport, Landtrust.com, Hi-Viz Shooting Systems, and ESPAmerica.com. Well, around here, working real hard on my own shooting, so I'll be a little selfish and ask Don Curry a few bits of advice for me, but hopefully they're applicable to you as well. Particularly working on this kind of soft focus thing so that you're not distracted, if you want to call it that, when a bird flies or a target flies. You're just kind of waiting, ready for anything. And then when that thing does launch, zoom, laser-like, focusing on that. I'm lucky enough to be able to do that a lot. Got a great place to shoot nearby and got my own clay target launcher with a time delayed release on it, so I can practice pretty much any time the snow isn't too deep. Also getting to visit with friends who join me at the real range once in a while, including my friend Lanny, who was my veterinarian for 25 years and four dogs, so always fun to turn that into a little bit of a reunion there. How about yourself? Well, you're thinking hard about next season. That's what I'm told by many of you. But I thought I'd ask you something that might be useful right about now. So on the social media pages, I asked for your most important bit of shotgun care advice. And boy, I got some great stuff. I appreciate it. Jay Walsh, hey, good to hear from you, by the way. Thanks a lot. Use snap caps when you're storing your guns. That'll relieve the springs in your firing pin. Absolutely. Walt Bungard says, don't overdo the cleaning and oiling, and have a little warming and dehumidifying bar in your safe. Yeah, great idea. Jason D. Williamson, the more one shoots it, i.e. your gun, the happier one is. Yeah. Have your gun fitted. I know that's not gun care advice, but Tobin Shadwick, it's always a good idea. Chuck Hickey likes those boar snakes, and use them when your barrels are still warm. Great idea. I like that. Good. Thanks a lot for that one. John Kozlowski, don't forget to oil springs and a firing pin. Careful. And always point the muzzle in a safe direction. Never can tire of safety advice. All right, every time you take it into the field, clean out the bores and coat with a light coat of oil. John Pivetta, thank you very much. Lance Larson, if your double barrel shotgun has the barrels on top of each other, it has been put together incorrectly. Replace it immediately with one that has the barrels in the correct orientation. Get it, everybody? Your eyes are next to each other. Yeah, absolutely. And then this from Ravenwood Lodge, my friend Ken Corbett over there reminds everybody that when you store your guns, stack them with the barrels down and the wood up. That way, if you were a little generous with the oil, it won't soak into your stock, and your wood will not get as many nicks. Yeah, yeah, you never thought about the fact that oil will soften the wood. And then Paolo Benedetti has the best advice of all when it comes to caring for your shotgun. Never sell one. Absolutely. So true. Right? Oh, yeah. Well, thank you all for your advice. Lots of good stuff in there. I'm sure we learned something already. And that segment of the show brought to you by Pro Plan Sport Dog Food from Purina. I guess that's how we pronounce it in this country. Learn more at ProPlanSport.com. I do. I'm learning every time I talk with somebody over there and every time I read about them. You know, the idea behind the ratios of ingredients and then the things that come out of that are all designed to optimize oxygen metabolism. Because that means increased endurance during exercise. And man, if you don't realize what an athlete your dog is, well, go to ProPlanSport.com and learn more about how all of that works. It's all part of the whole idea that your dog is a elite athlete and they know how to fuel that athlete. And if you want to shoot better, well, just keep listening, including to my friends at HighVizSights.com. You know, the company was founded by a shotgunner so that he could do a little bit better job of hitting birds and clay targets. That's why they offer so many choices. Magnetic, screw attach, plain barrel sights. Hey, anybody can install them. And if you want a little bit of help, they'll walk you through it if you need it. There's a reason their original equipment on Ruger's, Benelli's, Browning's, Remington, among others. You want to learn more about their choices when it comes to sights and how those sights will help you become a better shooter. I'm learning every day. Soon to be making a video on that. Anyway, go to HighVizSights.com. That's HighVizSights.com. Well, it's time to check in with my favorite shooting instructor because the guy is also a hunter and he knows his stuff. And what we're here to do is learn about shooting better for hunting. And there's nobody better to do that than Don Curry. Don is not only the chief instructor for the National Sporting Clays Association, he's got the number one rated Sporting Clays DVD on Amazon.com. All sorts of ways to learn from him. Go to DonCurry.com to learn more. Don, welcome back to the Upland Nation podcast.
Thank you, Scott. It's always a pleasure.
Well, since I talked with you last, you've been around the world almost literally doing things like that. But let's start with what you're doing these days professionally. Where can we go and what can we learn from you?
Well, thanks for asking. And again, it's great to be with you again, Scott. I love your podcast. So, yeah, I've gone through a little bit of change since the last time we spoke. So I was traveling quite a bit, sometimes to California, upper Midwest, you know, Wisconsin, Minnesota, Georgia, North Carolina, and Florida. Now I've sort of consolidated things, and I'm located in a permanent structure at a sporting clays course that is also co-located with a Boy Scout camp. So we're in Paisley, Florida, which is sort of halfway between Orlando and Ocala, so central Florida. And we just have a great location to teach and shoot. It's a private course, but obviously anyone that comes to take lessons or do fittings with me can come to that location. And what makes it really great is that we have it's a 15-station course, but we have four traps on every station. So we have sort of a let's say a corporate level target selection and then a more advanced target selection, as well as a five stand and a practice area, which I use to sort of start students out at the beginning of a lesson if I've never worked with them before, as well as for my gun fittings. And I do a lot of custom gun fittings for custom guns that we order from the factory. I don't do much off the shelf type things.
Sure.
Just because most everything I do on the gun sales side is connected with a custom stock, either restocking a current gun or ordering a new custom stocked gun from the factory. And there's a good mix of sporting stocks and guns and game guns on both sides of the fence there. So
what do you see in that world, especially in the world of game guns? Where are people going from a brand standpoint? What kind of models are they looking for? Is there any trend in that world? You know, if we won the lottery last Saturday night and we were coming to you, what would we likely bring to you?
Yeah, so that's a great question, because I get a lot of questions on, like, how do I figure out what gun's best for me? There's a bunch of elements there. I'll try to run through them with time in mind. So the first two questions that I ask is, number one, what's your budget? And number two, what's the utility of the gun? In other words, what are you going to use it for? So, you know, every once in a while I get somebody saying, well, you know, my budget's around X, but and I'd like to be able to use it for both, mm-hmm. you know, sporting clays and upland bird hunting. And that doesn't always work in terms of, no matter what price range you're at, in terms of having one gun to do both sporting clays and upland. Now, there are a lot of upland bird hunters that, and this is why I dig a little deeper when I'm trying to find out what the end game is. So what is the end goal of the shooter? Now, if their end goal is upland bird hunting, and they say, well, yeah, you know, but I shoot sporting clays too. I said, okay, but do you shoot sporting clays for competition, or, you know, to beat your buddy, or maybe in charity shoots, or do you just shoot sporting clays to get better at upland bird hunting? And if the answer is, well, I shoot just sporting clays just to get better at upland bird hunting, then we're talking about one gun.
Yeah.
If we're talking about, I go quail hunting 2-3 times a season, you know, upland over dogs, but then I also like shooting sporting clays. I shoot quite a bit once a week with my buddies, and we'll go to some charity shoots every now and then, or maybe I actually shoot in registered tournaments, whether it's trap, skeet, sporting clays. Then we're probably talking about two guns.
Yeah, and it's like anything else. I would imagine, you know, the more specialized you become, the more specialized your tools need to become. I get that. That's absolutely true. Most of us, of course, are using our hunting gun for the clay target shooting we do. Are they going to? Are we primarily talking over and under? Are we talking, side by sides, automatics? So, what seems to be the biggest, most attractive configuration these days?
Sure. Well, you know, it doesn't make sense to use an over and under for, in most cases, for a waterfowl, for example.
Yeah.
So in waterfowl, I typically recommend, and we see most hunters using a semi-automatic in that instance. And that's usually a single purpose gun. They can use it for, shooters can use it for waterfowl, dove, you know, whatever the case may be for a gun like that. And that's, you know, that's not bad. We're looking at, let's say $1,600 and up, you know, for whether it's a Benelli or an A400 Beretta. Those are the ones that I see most in sort of the up, let's say the waterfowl and dove markets. And they're both good brands. I tend toward the Beretta simply because it's a gas operated semi-automatic versus a recoil operated semi-automatic, which is a Benelli. So I think that Berettas are a little softer in terms of the recoil. Regardless of which one of those you might choose or another semi, a lot of hunters are surprised to find out that you have to use at least a shell with a speed of 1250 or more. I see some folks come to me for lessons, and they'll show up and they just bought a case at Bass Pro Shop that happens to be 1210. And depending on the shell, that may work. But to be safe, you want to shoot at least a 1250 or more. I know for upland waterfowl, you know, there's not much problem.
It's the target loads. So how about a strictly an upland hunter like me? Am I going to be walking in most of the time with something other than a semi-automatic?
For sure. Yeah. You know, the classic upland hunter is shooting either an over and under or a side by side. Rarely do you see someone shooting a semi-automatic in an upland situation, and there are a lot of shooting grounds and plantations around the country that simply won't allow a semi-automatic. So it's just much safer and frankly more genteel and more more in the mood of upland bird hunting, I would say, with an over and under or a side by side, for sure.
A lot easier than buying tweeds and a pair of plus fours.
Go. Yeah, you never see anybody in tweeds with a semi-automatic. Yeah.
Okay, not that no judgment here, everybody. So I'm going to be a little selfish here. Well, I will be the whole time, actually, but I have a good friend who is shopping for a youth gun for a grandson. We're narrowing it down in many ways, and you know, one of the options is, I got so many guns, why don't we just cut the stock off, do something else, blah blah blah. What, just generally speaking, if we're buying a gun for a youngster, what are the things we should be cognizant of? My first thought, and maybe you can argue this or not, is it's about balance. You shorten a stock, the barrel's still the same length, all of a sudden that gun is not swinging the way it should be, mounting the same way. But you tell me, what kind of advice would you give us?
Sure. I mean, you've intimated. I mean, the most important thing is you get a gun that fits reasonably well. And what does that mean? That means the length of pull, the distance between the front face of the trigger and the butt pad, that's going to be the most critical dimension for comfort for a youth shooter. And to give you a little bit of a side story, a good friend of mine and a fellow level 3 instructor works out of Greater Houston Gun Club, and he runs multiple youth teams. Mm-hmm. And he says, he told me the last time I was down there, he said, you know, what we've learned through experience is we've got to do a refit. We've got to at least do a cursory refit about every 6 months with these kids.
Oh, I bet.
They're growing like weeds.
Yeah.
And so I thought that was very interesting. And he's unique in that he runs so many kids through his program and has so many youth teams. So the first thing, as you intimated, is that we want to have a gun that fits well, is the right length of pull. And, how do we determine that? Well, there's certain things that we fitters do to determine that, and we can certainly talk about that. But there's nothing wrong with taking a stock that's a wood stock and cutting it down to the proper size and putting a new butt pad on. And if you look at some of the videos, you can on YouTube, you can see how to do that, or you can come to someone like myself or others. Most gunsmiths, that's a fairly easy operation. Mm-hmm. To fit the gun pad to a gun. It has to be ground down. But now you got two choices there. You can either take a wood stock that you have, cut it down, or you can order a new plain Jane stock, not great wood or anything like that on the internet, so that you can then put your old stock back on when you want to take it out versus having your your grandson fitted to the gun.
And, sure, yeah.
Having a gun fitter or an instructor look at that is not a bad idea. And then you can have the gun cut down, the stock cut down to the proper length. But having the ability to use the old stock and the new stock, and it really depends on the manufacturer, but even getting a used stock online and then cutting it down is a good solution, because then you're not really lowering the value of the gun if you ever decided to sell it. Because you've got the original stock to fall back on.
And I could see, as your friend said in Houston, you cut it back, the kid grows, he needs a new shoe size, his pants are too short. You could just put a thicker pad on for a while. You could just keep adding pad till they grow into a standard size stock, couldn't they?
You nailed it, Scott. I mean, that's exactly right. And, you know, again, you don't really care about the quality of wood or what the stock looks like at that point.
Yeah.
Because by the time he approaches 5'10", and he started out at 4'8", you know, that stock's going to look pretty darn ugly, and you might need to look for another solution. But absolutely, and there are also stock extenders. So
yeah.
Pretty easy just to add, a half inch, really up to an inch of length on a stock. And even if it requires, spacers and you want it to look a little more professional or a little more finished, again, a gunsmith can easily add spacers and grind a new pad for the gun. So I would say try to stick, if you don't have that gun and are looking for a gun for your grandson or a young kid, get something that is wood rather than synthetic, because you're going to have a tough time lengthening that stock. Although there are a lot of composite stocks out there, or guns with composite stocks that are great, and they actually market them as youth guns, but they're not as easy to cut down or add length to.
Oh, I believe it. Yeah. Well, let's switch gears before the break, because I do want to talk a little bit about at least one of your hunting trips. Everybody I know, and including David Petzl, who I respect and admire, the shooting editor for Field and Stream magazine for a million years, Sergeant Petzl once told me that you should go to Africa. It will change your life. And you just did. Tell me more.
Well, I would have to endorse that statement. So I went to Africa for the first time about 5 years ago, and it was sort of on a fluke. I was actually going with a friend of mine on somewhat of a mission trip, and he asked me before we left, is there something, I know you're going to come help me, but is there something I can do to make this trip special for you? And I said, well, now that you mention it, you could work a hunt in there.
Yeah.
So the first time I went, I hunted plains game, not any birds or winged animals. But I said to myself, boy, this is going to be great, but I better do everything I want to do on this trip, because I can't see myself ever going back.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
The fact is, I've been back 4 times.
Oh, so, my God.
So it is absolutely incredible. The species of animals, both legged and winged, are just spectacular, and they make North American game look a bit boring in terms of their color. So they've got some incredible plains game hunts. If you're a deer hunter, you just got to go one time in life. But I've had since then experiences not just with plains game, but with both waterfowl and upland birds. So and the species there, particularly in waterfowl, are just spectacular and species that you just don't see here. So I've got I was a pretty big waterfowl hunter a while back before I went to Africa. And when I look at the duck mounts on my wall, and then compare them to some of the ones in South Africa. They're a little down color, if you know.
Oh, what I mean. Isn't so, that interesting?
Yeah, no, they're just absolutely spectacular. Some of the waterfowl over there. But I've also hunted guinea fowl in Franklin.
Yeah,
over dogs.
Yeah,
and just a ton of fun.
Well, you mentioned that waterfowl in America pale by comparison, almost literally. Is that what it is? It's about these multicolored, incredibly psychedelic critters out there?
Yeah, it's just ones that we don't see on this side of the globe. But not to say that the hunting's worse or better. That's like any other place, right? It's depends on the day and the conditions and all of that, and the weather temperature over time, and you know, many factors, as you know. But the species is what's really spectacular. And if you and I think that's why we as duck hunters love duck hunting, because what's really cool about it is you're typically not just hunting one species of duck.
Yeah.
You have an opportunity to hunt multiple species in the same hunt.
Yeah.
In a lot of places. So, but if you're an avid waterfowl hunter, or you're an avid upland bird hunter, South Africa, or the African continent, offers just a whole nother world that's open to you in terms of the difference in species.
Let's talk about that upland thing. First off, is it much different than here? Granted, you're in another hemisphere. You're working with guys who have different accents. What I know about that world is they're bringing in a lot of pointers from the U.S. or somewhere else. They're out there walking around just like we are in the same kind of, birdie country. But describe the places you go for an upland hunt there. What does it look like?
Yeah, so a lot of times they're in fields that are being farmed.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And in terms of how they hunt, the species that they hunt with, they tend to be a little closer, and this is probably a proximity issue, but they tend to follow European and British tradition a little closer than they would American hunters. It all started in England, as, mm-hmm. And certainly in Europe, in terms of shotgunning. And so that's they tend to, so the cockers are you're not going to see as many labs as you will cockers, English setters, English pointers, that sort of thing.
Are they basically doing, you did mention this, but let's just be clear, they're doing what over there in England they would call rough shooting, put the dogs down. Maybe the cockers are at heel, I don't know, and just send in pointers out there to look for birds. Is that?
No, that's exactly right.
Yeah.
I mean, and I don't, if there are put and take places there, I don't know of them.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's it tends to be a much larger percentage of wild birds than wild bird hunting versus plantation shooting preserve type hunting, which you see a lot larger percentage of that here than there.
Anything unusual, unique about hunting South African upland birds? I mean, do you it's the southern hemisphere. Do you point left when you want to shoot right, or?
No, it's about the same.
Okay, and the water still circles the drain in a clockwise direction,
I tell you, the other species that's just a blast to shoot. I went to I think there's a video on my website of pigeon, rock pigeon shooting.
Yeah.
And that was just, and typically they do that in southern part of Africa, over sunflower fields.
Oh,
and that is a lot of fun. I mean, a lot of action. Again, it depends on the day and the location, but The time that I went for the first time, which was I think two or three trips ago, it was just a fantastic experience. A lot of action. You know, whenever here's my criteria. It's a great hunt when you can't load fast enough.
I'll take your word for that one. Absolutely. Oh my, that sounds great. So definitely we should all go. If we're going, and maybe even not just whether it's South Africa or not, but if we're traveling a long way and we're a bird hunter, are we generally going to be able to take our own shotguns? And is that a good idea? What about some other travel advice like that?
That's a really good question, because I've learned what I'm about to share with you the hard way. So there are agents in South Africa that can really grease the skid for you. So instead of just reading it online and trying to figure it out yourself and filling out the right paperwork, and maybe you got the right paperwork, maybe you don't. Trust me when I tell you, don't go to South Africa without hiring an agent. I want to say it's like 150, 200 bucks, something like that. So worth the money, because you can communicate with them by email, and you can get everything done in advance. And if you do that, and I've done both without and with, and you're through that process in about 20, 30 minutes.
What will they do for you? I mean, if we're just going in, blind,
sure.
Will they take us from point A to point Z? Is that the idea? So licensing, gun importation, what else?
Well, you definitely want to check with whoever your outfitter is, right? In South Africa, for example, or Mexico, or wherever or Europe, or wherever you're going. You definitely want to check with your outfitter in terms of local licensure.
Yeah.
What they will do for you, though, is they'll basically meet you after baggage claim. Uh-huh. What happens is when you're transporting a gun internationally, they're not going to put that on the conveyor belt where you pick up your luggage. They're gonna pull that in the back in the baggage department, and that'll end up in wherever the police office is, and they'll hold on to that until you come in and pick it up. So typically, what happens is after you've gone through customs, you picked up your bags, and you're now going out to the outside of the secured area where you'd normally meet anyone that's waiting for you. The agent will meet you there and greet you, and then take you to the police office. By that time, you've communicated with them prior to your trip, and they have filled out all the paperwork for you, and they know the people that are inside the police office. So it's a completely different and significantly better process when you're dealing with an agent. So it was very, very easy when I used an agent, and I would never travel to Africa or any other country without using an agent. It's just worth the price, because think about the worst case scenario.
Yeah,
if you don't have
yeah.
the I's dotted and the T's crossed, you could end up at this hunt that you spent a lot of money getting to without your gun. And it's just not worth the risk.
Yeah, of course, that can happen here in the States, too. Take my word for it, but which is why
sure,
I drive
I
everywhere now.
Here a lot, and I don't know if you wanted to discuss that, but there is sort of a fairly standard process. There's a little bit of variation from airport to airport.
Good. Well, that's Don Curry. He's the chief instructor for the National Sporting Clays Association, but he's also a bird hunter, as you can hear. We'll bring it on home, literally, into the States, and some more domestic advice coming up in the second half of the podcast. We'll also be taking a couple lessons from the road in our road trip segment, where I will share some of the things I've learned the hard way. It's all coming up in just a moment. Don, you get a moment to breathe and pour a coffee while I pay the bills around here, starting with landtrust.com. Looking at another Montana trip, it's like a candy store, and I'm a kid. No, I don't mean immature. I mean the choices are so great. Just in Montana, if you're looking for a place where the habitat's going to be good, you know the place has been vetted, and you want exclusive private access for a day or more, LandTrust.com is where you want to start. They have got so many choices, kind of like an Airbnb, but for folks like us. You can camp at a lot of these places. You will learn more about the place from the folks at LandTrust.com before you get there than you could ever do by knocking on doors. Take a look at all the choices at LandTrust.com. And whether you're looking for a new choke for your turkey gun or for your target gun or for your upland birds for this season, go to TrueLockChokes.com. 2,000 choices, lifetime warranty, satisfaction guarantee. What can I tell you? These guys know what they're doing. A better choke will make you a better shooter, better materials, better engineering. I know I use that term a lot, but it's absolutely true. The pattern will be better, too. Learn more at TrueLockChokes.com. And you spell TrueLock, T-R-U-L-O-C-K, TrueLockChokes.com. And welcome back to the Upland Nation podcast. Don Curry with the National Sporting Clays Association and all sorts of hunting opportunities as well. Hey, let's transition from South Africa, Don, to closer to home. When we're out there and you're out there, whether it's on the range teaching a lesson or you are actually out in the field with somebody, what are some of the bigger challenges we all face when it comes to actually shooting at flying game birds?
I think that the biggest obstacle that hunters encounter is the mount. You'd think in hearing that, okay, well, that means I need to improve my mount. No, typically it's the speed of the mount. It is certainly the quality of the mount, so to speak, but it's also the speed of the mount. So I find that particularly in the beginning of a hunt,
yeah,
for a beginning hunter, you tend to be overly concerned about getting the gun up to the cheek and shoulder as quickly as you can. And what happens when you do that is the eye is immediately pulled off of the target, which is the bird, and to the front of the gun. And there's just too much going on in front of immediately in front of your face to really maintain that good visual connection with the bird all the way, you know, through the mount and through the trigger pull. So, you know, certainly quality of mount, and we can talk about that, is a major issue. But also a major issue is the speed of the mount.
Yeah.
Because normally a quick mount will yield a lot of turbulence at the end of the gun at the muzzle end that'll prevent you from to a certain degree from focusing well on the target and connecting well with the bird just prior to and through your shot execution.
Bingo. For 100 rounds yesterday, I thought about exactly that. I've learned that a nice, deliberate mount makes the most sense. I never thought about it in terms of allowing you to stay focused on the target. And then, of course, you use the great term turbulence at the end of the gun. I love that idea. All those things happen when you're too rushed in your gun mount, and I'd never put it together before.
Well, that's right. And I say to my students quite often, we actually kill the bird with our eyes. We don't kill the bird with the shotgun.
Yeah.
That may seem like a contradiction, but the fact is, in shotgunning, we point, we don't aim, such as in rifle and pistol shooting, we point. So, the accuracy of our point will be directly proportional to the quality of the connection we have with our target. So smoothing out the mount, just slowing it down just a touch, you know, will allow the eyes to have continuous connection with the target, and our subconscious therefore will bring the hands and the gun to the target, much more likely to bring the hands and gun to the target then if we interrupt that eye target connection with an inefficient mount.
Talk to me about practice at home. Okay, you know, some of us get to the range more often than others of us, but we all have a gun. We all have a safe place to shoot and shoot to mount an unloaded gun. I've been taught before in many worlds that that the best teaching tool can often be a full length mirror. But maybe you have better advice for us or some more along those lines. What can we do at home to work on those sort of things?
Well, you know, we don't need to, here in Florida, we don't need to practice in our homes much. But up where you are, you know, you're pretty much sequestered at a certain part of the season, or at least in certain weather conditions, to the inside. So that is right. I mean, there are a number of things, and I'm jesting, of course. I mean, even for those of us in Florida, there are things we can do at home that can actually improve our performance in the field. And let's start with the biggest mistake I see at home practice, and that is that you tend to get some shooters would tend to get in front of a mirror with their empty gun and just mount to the mirror vertically each and every time. And that's not the best way to practice your mount. And the reason for that is you'll then, when you get in the field or on the sporting clays course, you'll tend to do what I call squaring off the mount. So you'll tend to mount then move. Mount and the move are supposed to happen simultaneously. Not in a two-step fashion where you mount and then move, because the moment you get the gun up in your face, you now have many fewer reference points with which your brain can determine line and speed of the target, whether it has wings or it's a clay. So when you do practice at home, it's important that you move, you practice moving and mounting simultaneously. One of the things, if you want to go, if you're on the cheap and want to do this in the least expensive way, get a laser pointer, or maybe even a little pen light, and rubber band it to the end of your gun, use get into the room, the largest room in your house, and use the seam between the wall and the ceiling as your flight path of the target, your imaginary flight path.
Yes,
and go from the left corner to the right corner to an imaginary target, keeping that beam of light on that seam between the wall and the ceiling, starting your mount on one corner and ending your mount on another corner. So moving and mounting simultaneously is what you want to practice indoors, not that vertical mount. And that more frequently than not results in a shooter getting into a bad habit of squaring off move and mount.
You know, the other thing that I've used is number one, snap caps, because I think the moment of truth in our gun mount and our shooting is when we actually pull the trigger. And a lot of us, we won't do that without snap caps in there. The other thing that I've had fun with is I got a little oscillating fan. And I put another pen light on the top of that thing, and it goes back and forth across that wall.
That's a great idea. You got me there, Scott. I've never had that one suggested, but it makes complete sense.
It is so fun.
and it's a lot cheaper than the unit on my website.
Oh yeah, well, yeah, so, yeah.
That you already have the fan.
Yeah, there is a real way to do that. Everybody, Don's got them. So
no, you're absolutely right. There's a couple products I have on my website. One is just it's a little fancier version of the pen light I was just describing,
with a
little wire that goes back to your finger, and when you contact the it's called a laser shooter, and then there's another device that does exactly what your oscillating fan does, which is it projects one or two little red dots like a laser pointer, and you can program it for crossers, for trap shots, for quartering shots, you know, you and singles and doubles. So
nice.
It depends on how fancy you want to get.
But the idea being everything needs to move.
Yes, and move and mount needs to happen simultaneously.
Righto. Yeah. Now, but speaking of squaring up to the mirror, if we're looking at what I'll loosely describe as a do-it-yourself gun fitting, even if it's just basic preliminary for the, you know, just because I just got it today and I want to shoot it tomorrow, the mirror might be one of the things you would suggest we do, but what could we do to ensure that gun out of the box maybe is can we do anything to make it better for
sure.
us?
No, that's a great question, and I'm now going to be in the process of talking myself out of a bunch of gun fits. But anyway, I actually encourage the folks to do this. So one of the ways you can test a gun fit is to get in front of a mirror, as you suggest. And the thing I find is that most shooters, when I'm conducting a gun fit, they mount very differently in a static environment, which is in a gun room or in your house or whatever, than they will on a patterning board.
Mm.
And that is then again different from the way they will mount on a bird. So the first, if you're going to do a home test, my first encouragement is that you make sure that you try to think through, okay, how do I normally mount my gun? And, you know, in a field environment or in a sporting clays environment, and try to mount the gun as closely as possible as you can to the way you would mount in the field. So having said that, if you just put a dot on a mirror that's right around the height of your eye, and then you mount to that dot, looking only at the dot, and then you freeze, okay? So you mount to that dot, on the mirror that you've put it about eye height, and you freeze. Now you look at the position of your eye over the rib. So in an ideal world, that the iris, the color part of the eye, would be centered on the rib. So it would be neither left nor right, but centered. And the iris would be on the rib like a marble on a table. Okay. So the bottom of your iris should be even with the bottom part of the top part of the rib. Now, some would say, well, wait a minute, that doesn't look right when I do that. That looks like I see a lot of rib. And the fact is, you will see rib. You're supposed to see rib in a shotgun scenario, not so much in a rifle scenario where we're manually and consciously lining up the sights of a rifle with a stationary target.
Sure.
And shooting moving targets with a shotgun, we want our whole iris sitting on the rib like a marble on a table, because that is what lets the highest quality and greatest quantity of imagery enter the eye and the brain.
Duh. Who'd have thunk that? But you're absolutely right. We don't need anything blocking our vision. And that's what the muzzle would do, wouldn't it?
It would. And when we have the comb, of course, the comb is the top of the stock, right? When that comb is too low for a shooter, they will mount the gun. And if you got all the way down at the end of the gun and look back, which you don't want to do unless you verify that it's safe. But if you looked in your mirror, okay, you wouldn't even see your shooting eye, which in the case of a right-handed shooter is the right eye. So the right eye would fall below the rib. Now you're seeing the target with your non-shooting eye, and that's going to cause all kinds of inaccurate results. So
I know that one very well. Being cross-dominant,
yeah. And if it's too high, if the comb happens to be too high, and you have too much of a gap between where the eye is and the plane of the rib, you may shoot too high. It just depends on the individual and how much they subconsciously float the target, you know, above the rib.
Well, we talk a lot, Don Curry, about gun mount and gun fit, but we come to you, you probably put as much emphasis on foot position as most other things. And I've come to a conclusion recently. I've been all over the board on this one. And if you've shot with me or watched me on the show, you know, I used to have some pretty wacky foot positions, but they worked at the time. Now I'm pretty much convinced that the number one priority is both feet should be flat on the freaking ground, period. And nothing else matters if that ain't happening.
Well, I can't say nothing else matters, but that is true. Both feet.
Well, that's number one, though, right there.
Yeah. And that, right. No, you're exactly right. And I would add to that that your feet need to be oriented in such a way that your body can move freely to whatever your lateral target area is going to
right.
be.
Right. Yeah. So you can swing more. You can swivel exactly. more. Swivel more is better.
And I will also say that the a right-handed shooter, for example, can more easily move the gun to the center of his body, pointing out, than he can move to the left, too far to the left. So making sure the body is sufficiently open to the target area so that you can move from the ankles to anything, you know, inside of that, let's say, you know, 12 o'clock to 5 o'clock area. If 12 o'clock is directly in front of us. But generally, in terms of foot position, we want to have the lead foot or the left foot as a right-handed shooter pointing in the general direction of where we're going to pull the trigger.
Right.
And that just gives you the least amount of tension. That's true for a right-handed shooter. For a left-handed shooter, we want that lead foot or the right foot to be somewhere in the approximate direction of where we're going to pull the trigger. When I say approximate, for a right-handed shooter, if the target's at 12 o'clock, the left foot should be right around 1 o'clock.
Sure.
For a left-handed shooter, if the target is at 12 o'clock, we want our right foot to be right around 11 o'clock of the intended target area.
Do you ascribe to the theory of a little step to get your foot there? Because I'm thinking, well, yeah, especially if we got a pointing dog and we're flying the birds ourselves, as we should be, we got to keep walking until the bird flies. And we don't know when that's going to happen. We can just stand there, I guess, and wait until the bird is scared. But most of the time, we're going to be moving up on that bird. It flies. We got a foot in the air. Do we make a little step?
Well, I think it comes back to your first point, which is you got to have both feet on the ground. So it could be that when you see the bird, your feet are already there. But if the dogs are on point and you're walking up, then yeah, I mean, the first thing you want to do is get that lead foot in the right position
right.
to react to whichever direction the bird is going in your sector of fire, so to speak.
Yeah, right? Yeah.
If you're on the left side, that's, you know, 9 o'clock to 12 o'clock. If you're on the right side, 12 o'clock to 3 o'clock. So yeah, it's that's the first thing you want to do is plant that lead foot. In terms of the back foot, I don't get too specific with that. And the reason is because if you have different people stand just still, you'll notice, and then look at their feet, you'll notice that some people stand with their feet parallel, and then others, you know, there's probably, that can be like a 90-degree angle to you know, at the extreme,
sure,
for some people. So it's really where is the body most comfortable, you know, in turning. And so Churchill, for example, Robert Churchill, was more of a portly guy. And so if his left foot, if as a right-handed shooter, if his left foot was right around 1 o'clock, his right foot was more around 3:30.
Mm-hmm,
whereas, mm-hmm. Percy Stanbury, for example, another British shooter and famous British shooter that wrote quite a bit about our sport. You know, he was more parallel and his feet were closer together. He was a thinner, lankier guy. So it the back foot I don't get too anal about, but the front foot's important to have that planted in the general direction of where you anticipate pulling the trigger. And in an upland situation, if you're, say, a right-handed shooter on the left side of the dog, you want to open up your stance a little bit just in case that bird goes to the 10 o'clock, for example.
Yeah, especially if you got a guy on the other side of the dog, too. So you have two fields of fire.
Very true.
What about it came up again recently, and you know, it's almost scary sometimes how radical that front foot can be for some people. What's the downside to really extending that lead foot way out there, and where should our feet actually be in relation to, say, our shoulders or our hips?
Sure. So let's say that the heels, you want the heels no more than 12 inches apart. And a lot of shooters, particularly in a unpredictable upland bird hunting environment and scenario, they will oftentimes tend to have their feet spread too far apart. And when you do that, your ability to turn from the ankles is now limited, and your angle of movement is also going to be limited. So having the front foot generally pointed at the, you know, let's say for a right-handed shooter on the left side of the dog, if your left foot was pointed somewhere around 10:30, okay, you could easily turn and shoot a bird from 9 to 12,
sure,
and you'd be just fine. But you want those heels, you know, if you measure, took out a ruler, measure between the heels, you want that somewhere between 8 and 10 inches, ideally.
Yeah.
And most people would say, well, wait a minute, I shoot with my feet a lot further apart.
Yeah.
And you know, you can get a shot off that way, but you're not going to be able to turn from the ankles as well when your feet are further apart. You're not going to have the movement that you need, and it could be that you actually get too much torque in your body, and you're going to miss that bird that flies to the 10 o'clock versus hitting the bird.
Somebody described a very similar problem. They described that arc that you get when you're swinging, and your swing is restricted. They called it the rainbow arc because you're following that bird up, but at some point your body just starts pulling your muzzle down.
Very true. So at the farthest limits of your move, so for a right-handed shooter, as they move more toward the 9 o'clock, right, from 12 o'clock to 9 o'clock, they're going to subconsciously start to dip their shoulder, their left shoulder, which will cause you to obviously come off target and shoot under a bird rather than on the bird. So very true.
Okay, give me one more. I am being selfish here, but the target I missed the most yesterday was I'm cross-dominant. I shoot right. I put a patch on my shooting glasses on my left lens. Hard right to left crosser. Is that because of not keeping my cheek on the stock, or is that because of that rainbow arc, or is there something else I should be doing next time I go practice that, Don?
Well, where are you pulling the trigger? What on a clock direction? Where
well,
do you think you're pulling the
trigger? Good question. And I was letting them get out, so they were really hard crossers. So I was probably pulling the trigger at 9 o'clock.
Oh, well, see that. There you go. So you were on the left side of the dog.
Yes.
Obviously. Right. Yeah. So one of the little tricks that sometimes doesn't seem natural and seems a little counterintuitive is if I'm on the left side of the dog, I want to point that left foot toward that 10:30 rather than the 12 o'clock.
Yeah.
So most hunters on the left side will point, you know, toward the 12 o'clock, 1 o'clock.
Yep.
And a lot of shooters will naturally stand too oblique to the target, like a rifle shooter.
Mm-hmm.
So you want to try to open up that stance a little bit, pointing more to the 10:30 than the 12. So that's one, you know, one issue. The other issue would be, you know, what's your technique for shooting that target? Because there are really, you have to, most upland shots are just a point and shoot.
Yeah.
Right. But when you do get that right to left crosser, have you decided how you shoot right to left crossers? In other words, do you use sustained lead or do you use a pull away? How do you move the target?
Oh, I'll have to work on that. That's for sure. But
here's my tip for you.
Yeah.
Here's my tip for you. Next time you get the hard right to left crosser, touch the nose of the bird with a gun and then accelerate the gun in the direction of flight of the bird. So touch, I like to call it a touch and separate.
Yeah.
So just touch the bird and separate. And what's probably happening is you're probably checking the lead.
Yep.
The distance between the muzzle and the target. And which you, inevitably you're probably missing behind.
Well, that there's no doubt about that. Very seldom do I miss ahead, but that is always a goal, as they say. But that is very useful. And I think the other thing I take away from that is, as if you were shooting a lot of sporting clays, a lot of folks will suggest you set up your feet for where you think you're going to pull the trigger, not for where you think the target's coming from. So if you're already doing that a little bit, as much as you can with a target you don't know where it's coming from or going to, that might help me a little bit too.
No, bingo. That's exactly right. So in sporting clays, we know exactly where that, for a right-handed shooter, where that leftmost break point's going to be, where we're going to break that target that's as a break point, a point where we're going to break the target that's most left. So you're going to have a right target and a left target. Every once in a while, they're not, and that's not where the target's coming from. That's where you're going to break it.
Mm-hmm.
So the leftmost break point is where a right-handed shooter should be oriented to. But in an upland situation, you need to be able to anticipate and move to any bird that goes that comes, you know, that you have to shoot within that 9 to 12 range, right? That 9 to 12, what I call sectors of fire for my old Army days. So that sector of fire, you've got to be prepared to take any bird in there. And if you're aligned with the 12 o'clock, you're not as prepared to move the body to that 10 o'clock as you would be if you turn that left foot out to the 10 to 10:30 position rather than the 12 o'clock position.
Well, there you have it. This guy knows what he talks about. Don Curry is a chief instructor for the National Sporting Clays Association, also the award-winning author of two books, Mastering Sporting Clays and Gun Fitting. He's a course designer, instructor, coach, gun fitter. Guy knows his stuff. Someday we will actually spend some time in the field or maybe just at the range. I think that would be just as fun. Don Curry, thanks for joining us on the Upland Nation podcast.
Thank you, Scott. I always enjoy being with you.
Ditto. Take care now. But don't you go away. We're going to talk more about some of the lessons I learned from the road that will be of use to you this season. It's all coming up on the Upland Nation podcast, brought to you in part by MidwayUSA.com. Just ordered a fishing shirt at MidwayUSA.com. Just laid in a bunch more of flies for the season and more to come after that. So stand by, check out MidwayUSA.com for all your needs. Customer satisfaction is their number one goal. Don't forget to sign up for their email or text notifications. You'll get 10% off your next order. It's all at MidwayUSA.com. And SageandBreaker.com is where you get all of your gun cleaning and care and transport products. Yeah, big Father's Day sale coming up. You know why I know? Because I'm on their email list. I'm doing you a favor, giving you a heads up before everybody else. Now, if you sign up, you'll find out about those as well, especially new products coming in like those Midnight Camo hats now up on the site. The brush and pick tool roll kit is now on sale, as well as, let's see, range bags, a gun cleaning mat, and gun cases. So take a look at sageandbreaker.com. This week on the road trip, lessons I've learned the hard way so you don't have to. Yeah, well, kind of a mixed bag, but these are the some things. You know, I just kind of mentally pictured a few things in my mind that stuck with me over the last couple seasons and thought I'd just mention some of them to you. I'm in the market for a new set of off-road lights. I do a lot of driving in deer country at night, and if it ain't deer, it's black cattle. I've got a lot of off-road lights. I'm putting some more on, and you know where I'm putting them? Not on the roof. number one, because you're lighting up the sky instead of the road, not on the roof because of the wind noise. Yeah, so much up there, and it is not dispersed by anything like your brush guard, your bumper, the front of your hood, etc. So put those off-road lights lower and to the front whenever you can. Lots of travel with lots of dogs. You know what I'm talking about here. You're looking for a quiet, safe spot to exercise a dog or just walk them around or just air them out while you're on the road. Here are some of my favorites. When school is not in session, I Google schools when I'm passing through a small town. And as long as you're nice and, you know, considerate and clean up afterwards, most schools don't have a problem. In fact, I've had some great encounters with, you know, groundskeepers, janitors, football coaches. You put a funny looking dog like mine on a practice field for a while, you're going to draw at least a little bit of attention. And that's a good thing most of the time. A lot of churches are just as welcoming, even if all they have is a big parking lot. It sure beats those roadside rest stops. And finally, one of my favorites, fairgrounds. Every decent-sized town that's the county seat will have the county fairgrounds or better, so check them out. And by the way, a lot of them also have great little RV parks, so if you're looking for somewhere to go and you're on the road and you need to park for the night, take a look at the nearby fairgrounds as well. Yeah, those are just some of the things that I've picked up over the years that might be of value to you. I've got lots more of those, of course, and I'll be sharing them as we continue on down the road together. And the road trip this week is brought to you by ESPAmerica.com. Yeah, I am so enjoying my custom fit ESP hearing protection devices. Put them in, and when you're shooting at the range or even in a hunting situation, you are protecting what little hearing you have left. Yeah, it is cumulative. It is constantly being worn down until you protect it. Postpone as much hearing loss as you can by wearing hearing protection devices at the range and in the field. These are the best I've ever had, and I've had quite a few. Find out why at ESPAmerica.com. And put them in and then take a lesson at Mid Valley Clays and Shooting School. MidValleyClays.com is where you learn more about all of the things they have to offer, from lots of fun games to play, including Helis. Yeah, look it up. Or watch the video on their site, for that matter. Or on my site. Go to YouTube and watch that. And then, if you're shopping for a gun, whether it's a youth gun or anything else, Dave Fiedler is the guy to talk to. He will work you through the process, provide some objective advice about what you might want and what you might need. Dave is a bird hunter, dog owner, and an incredible shotgunning instructor. He'll ask the right questions and make some suggestions. So next time you're shopping, give him a call. Go to midvalleyclays.com and call Dave Fiedler. Well, I sure appreciate your listening. Thanks to Don Curry. If you want to learn more about Don and what he's doing in this world, go to Don Curry, CURRIE.com. DonCurry.com. Learn something, watch something, maybe pick up some tips and advice. If you commented at the social platforms, thank you. I appreciate all your suggestions this week, especially gun care advice and some humor in there as well. You guys ought to, yeah, man. You want to go on the road. If you left a rating or a review, I appreciate that. And I do appreciate our sponsors as well. Sage and Breaker, Purina Pro Plan Sport, ESP America, Mid Valley Clays, Truelock Jokes, MidwayUSA.com, LandTrust.com, and High Viz Shooting Systems. Yeah, I have had a great time. I hope you learned something from Don, and I know I did. And with luck, we'll see you down the road. I'm Scott Linden. Thanks for listening to the Upland Nation Podcast.